Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 25 for Wednesday, October 3rd, 2007. From the Human Genome Project to Space Exploration with Dr. George Church. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Invitrogen and the Zero Blunt Topo PCR Cloning Kit. It combines 5-minute topo cloning with their unique zero background technology. Visit Invitrogen.com/topo for details.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark. Years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Dr. Church agreed to do the show. I knew we'd be talking extreme biotech, but I really, and I mean really, had no idea. And since we only scratched the surface here, this will be a part one of two. So on to the interview. You did some work on the Human Genome Project, pretty much like the epicenter of it in the early 80s.
Yeah. So maybe going a tiny bit further back, I at one point I typed in all of the nucleic acid sequences. So I was a teenage crystallographer at the time. I typed them all in. And I thought, this is really great. We should really sequence everybody who wants it. And so I joined Wally Gilbert's lab, and we worked out genomic sequencing and multiplex sequencing together. And then around the time that actually the first paper on genomic sequencing was 1984, and I went to this meeting at the DOE held at Alta, whose point was to get at mutations in people exposed to energy sources of various sorts and chemical. And we decided in the first 10 minutes we couldn't do that. But hey, you know, maybe as a alternative, we could suggest a genome project. DOE liked that part. And I was one of the first grantees in 1987. And then pretty soon NIH decided that DOE couldn't have such an incredible chunk of such a possibly interesting chunk of human health. So they started a genome project, and I helped the three of the first centers get started, including one at Stanford, one in Waltham that became the only commercial part of the genome project, the public genome project, which is called Genome Therapeutics eventually. And then I helped, I was a co-PI on Eric Lander's first grant, which grew into the Whitehead Genome Center and later into the Broad Institute.
So one of the methods that you personally helped work out was sequencing straight from the genome.
Right.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, so we felt that one of the interesting things to be able to do was to be able to quickly resequence. And at the time, this was pre-PCR. The only way you could do that was by making a library, screening the library, and pulling like one clone out of this big library, and it was a whole production. And so we came up with the pre-PCR way of sequencing directly from the genome by basically sequencing the genome in its entirety at a chemical level, but not reading it out, and then running it out on it. At the time, everything was gel electrophoresis. And then probing it with one probe out of the genome, the way you would do a Southern blot. And that actually worked pretty well, and people wrote books on it, and that variations on that method were in use for 13 years, including the first complete microbial genome, first genome that was sold commercially in 1994. which was a year ahead of the first academically published genome in 1995.
So what was that like to be, well, first of all, this is almost Orwellian, right? This is a change in era back in the early 80s. I guess PCs are starting to come out. Some of the software to help us analyze these genomes as they're coming out is starting to be made available. And you're actually looking at the code for the first time, not one gene at a time, but, you know, the code as it was written, I suppose, or as it was evolved.
Well, to me, it wasn't that revolutionary, and it was more incremental. You know, you're kind of close up to it. And I had, like I said, I had typed in all the sequences in 1975. And so kind of between those 9 years was kind of slowly seeing more and more sequence. I'd done the first plasmid sequence with Greg Sutcliffe. And then we did the first, you know, one of the first operons, and then the first complete genome. And no point seemed that remarkable. But certainly seeing the first complete genome, we were, you know, one of the few labs that actually was unintimidated by the computational aspects of it. And there was just a lot to do. It was a lot of details and a lot of integration of tools and thinking about the biology. And it was fun. It was definitely fun to think holistically about the whole genome and knowing that nothing was missing unless you had messed up your software.
Did you have an idea of gene structure when this first started? And what was known in the 70s and 80s in terms of how the genome was organized?
You know, I think there actually were, from now and then we describe a bunch of things as surprises or discoveries, but I think there were really relatively few surprises. We had, you know, the idea that you would have an intron was new. And I remember I was excited enough about that I went to the seminar twice. but for the most part, we expected genes to either, you know, have little regulatory sequences upstream from them. Maybe it was a little surprising we started finding them in the middle and way upstream, like enhancers. We expected mammalian or variety of genomes to have a lot of extra DNA and weren't that would take us a while to figure out what it all was, but we sort of expected it to be of structural and regulatory significance.
So I guess it didn't give you the sense that you were sequencing alien DNA, but really this was how we worked, and we'd been working on it for a while and understood some of the components.
Yeah. I thought overlapping genes were really cool because, you know, it was like the whole, how would you code that and the genetic code and all that. But then I had the suspicion that it was not going to be very general, and it turned out it seems like it's not that general. There are very little protein coding regions that overlap.
Are those mostly in yeasts and bacteria where this happens?
They're mostly in icosahedral viruses, meaning where you have very limited amount of space for your genome.
So this means that you have a gene that's encoded on the same strip of DNA. Are they necessarily in the same direction on the DNA, or can they be?
No, they can be. There's 6 reading frames, 3 on the top and 4, 3 on the bottom. And you can have 2 frames used in any combination.
So
really,
this is like a crossword of sorts.
It turned out it was pretty limited. It was very few organisms show this, and it's fairly limited. Yeah, but it was kind of cool. It was one of the first genomes displayed it, which is 5X174.
Well, it certainly shows that the power of evolution to conserve the amount of chemistry required to synthesize a genome and make as much use out of it as possible, mm-hmm. Which is really neat. I guess, you know, when you've been playing with genomes for, you know, 20 some odd years, you sometimes have to take a step back and say, well, these are codes that regulate, you know, the process of life.
And that was the other thing that was kind of interesting. Fred Sanger found the overlapping genes, and he also found new genetic codes. And I remember that made me pause for a while and think about, you know, there's really no dogma that's worth embracing so much. In part, almost all these things had some surprise, and in a way you say, oh, I'm not surprised. But now, you know, there are quite a number of exceptions to genetic code. And one of the things we do in the lab is we're trying to create new genetic codes. So,
that was... Can that be done? Can you re-engineer?
Oh, yeah, sure. There probably aren't that many limitations on the genetic code if, you know, once you get into the synthetic biology way of thinking.
So your work, it reflects a lot of both a systemic and a synthetic level of detail, you know, getting an understanding of entire genomes to compare them to determine data or to retrieve data on biological processes. Is that correct to say? And then you also try to reinvent or re-engineer for the purpose of synthetic biology, repurpose the tools that we have?
Right. I mean, we try to not accept things the way they are. If there's a type of information that we need, then that isn't available with current instruments, then we'll make a new instrument or a new software, wetware. If there's something where we think we could improve on organisms with respect to a particular task, not their original task, but retasking them, then that's kind of an extension of what we would do with instruments. Is with due respect for the ecological and other responsibilities you have when you're engineering organisms.
So, or do you consider some of these organisms, as we discussed before we aired, as equipment?
Well, I think, yeah, there's the debate as to whether DNA is hardware or software or some interesting combination in a technological sense. They are devices that have a special property of replicating, and so they require a special kind of respect. Which is why people get regulatory concerns about genetically engineered or genetically modified organisms. And that's why one of the things that we set as our goals for my laboratory and for this field of synthetic biology, which distinguishes it from previous field, one of many things that distinguish it, is trying to put in a lot more quality control and safety features, which is sort of the way an engineer thinks about things. And I think that's it's ironic that genetic engineering was really not so much an engineering discipline, while synthetic biology is much more so. Not just quality and safety, but hierarchical assembly and inheritance of modular constructs and specification sheets and all that sort of thing that you expect of an engineering discipline. That's what we're trying to do in the field of synthetic biology.
So synthetic biology, in a sense, our understanding of the function of some, I guess we have a great understanding of some proteins and very little understanding of other proteins. And I don't know, at what point are we in our knowledge base of genes and their function to be able to really start constructing organisms with the purpose or retool?
Well, see, that's an interesting viewpoint. The analogy I would make is we understand some elements of the periodic table much better than others. We're not really in control of transition metals the way we are in control of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And so we tend to, as chemists and electrical engineers, use a very small set of elements that we trust. So to make a large-scale integrated circuit, we might use silicon and boron and phosphorus and copper and gold and a very small number of the 100 plus elements. And the same thing with synthetic biology. We are not obliged to use or even understand most of biology. We simply focus on the parts that we trust. And that's the key thing is, and then we take the parts we trust and we, by using them over and over and debugging with them and so forth, we learn more and more about them. We trust them more. And we alter them so that they're more trustworthy, and we put them into constellations where we can specify their parameters more precisely. We can move away from the sort of random behavior, the unpredictability of parts we don't understand into making them much more usable as tools. So it's really a subset, as your question prompted.
How large a subset? So, you know, we tend to think of, the omes, the proteomes and the genomes and the transcriptomes and the exomes or whatnot, orpheomes, looking at entire sets. But if you're saying we don't need to necessarily understand all of them, but understand the variability, I guess, or make predictions as to how reliable we can get things to happen, how big a part of the omes do we need to get a grasp of, to really take advantage of playing around with these processes?
Well, you could imagine that you could take a fairly tiny fraction and expand it. So, for example, let's say you really understand zinc finger DNA binding proteins much better than any other DNA binding protein. You could just forget about the others for a while and expand the zinc fingers. You could start with one zinc finger and make a whole library where you have every possible sequence there. And to some extent, that's the plan of the company Sangamo, with which I helped in early days. And that gets you a lot. Or you could say, I don't completely understand RNAi, but I can make riboregulators from first principles. And that's the sort of thing that Christina Smolke and Farron Isaacs in my lab made riboregulators pretty much from first principles. Or you can select them from scratch, where you make completely random polymers and bind them to something you want to have them bind to. And the tiny subset of that set of random polymers it binds, you can amplify, and then that is the part. So you made this part basically from scratch, basing it on functionality, what you wanted it to do, which is an opportunity you rarely get in most other fields of engineering, where you just slam a bunch of random stuff and the right thing comes out. so that required in terms of understanding was we needed to understand something basic about RNAs, that they could fold, and that evolution works in vitro from completely formless population to something that has functionality. So the part was almost entirely from scratch. So that's two examples, an RNA example and a DNA protein interaction example, but you could go from there. You really only need one example of each functionality. Now, when you get to enzymes, you probably want lots of enzymes, because those are hard to make from scratch, either by design or by evolution, like the aptamer, the binding RNA. And there you might actually want at some point, a collection of every enzyme that's ever done any reaction that you're interested in, even if it requires getting them from a lot of different organisms, which is another thing that synthetic biology does very well, is you can gather up whole pathways from multiple organisms and put them all in one organism.
Are projects like the Venture Around the World important in building those tools, or at least getting some of those genes that are novel for those pathways?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I fully support that kind of project. But take the zinc finger as an example. In that case, you needed one well-characterized zinc finger, and then you had the crystal structure, and you went in there and you changed the nucleotides that matter to the DNA interface, and you generate a whole library of every possible zinc finger you could ever want. And then you can select for them in vitro to do what they want. Now, that said, I also said for enzymes, we want every enzyme in the book to do, because they catalyze these exquisite kind of detailed, like watchmaker type things. Zinc finger you can think of as kind of like clay binding to a surface. It's really...
you can model it.
Yeah, it's in certain circumstances, it's easy. But with enzymes, there you might want to get a lot. But the problem with the going through the ocean is you only see things you already know. So you don't really easily get new enzymes. Or you get the new enzymes, but you don't know what they do, right? So you can get lots of examples of a hydrogenase, but you already have two really good examples of hydrogenases, the nickel iron and the iron hydrogenase. And the other, all the, they either fit in those two categories. So, but you see lots of solutions, and maybe if you want to perfect a parameter, you'll take a lot of different genes that you got from an environmental survey, and you'll recombine them with one another in vitro. And if you have a selection or a screen for that process, then you'll find it in either in the original collection you found in the environment or recombinants you created in the laboratory. So there's some power there. It hasn't been demonstrated in that many cases, but I think it's definitely worth looking at.
If I draw a parallel to the chemistry that's found in a rainforest, I suppose even though we could probably synthesize most of the organic molecules from scratch, seeing them in their environment gives you the context in which case you know that you need a tool to create an enzyme that can bind carbon dioxide under, you know, very stressful conditions or whatnot, or identify changes in pH in the water. You need those environmental cues, I suppose, to really, I mean, that the chemistry in the rainforest is, we could randomly synthesize it, but, you know, a million monkeys type, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good example, although it's more like the aptamer, the binding example, because the chemicals that most drug companies get from the rainforest aren't necessarily doing in the drug company what they do in the wild. In other words, we basically don't know what their function is in the wild and don't care. So quinine may not have been invented by the plant to cure malaria. Probably wasn't.
Right.
It had some other original purpose. And so we basically collect up all these chemicals and just throw them against problems and see which ones stick. And I think that's more like the aptamer. But the exquisite enzymes, if we found a new enzyme that did a really cool new thing, like, say, made carbon nanotubes in the rainforest or in the ocean, we wouldn't know it.
Right.
Well, it would be sitting there waiting for us, you know, to build cables and, you know, into space, and we wouldn't know it unless somebody had the insight to try a lot of assays.
So, do synthetic biology then? To me, it would benefit from having an organizational structure of having a lot of effort on retooling what's known. And then discovery science going on, looking for amazing things or amazing new tools.
I agree. I think the synthetic biology community kind of has a parasitic mode where it waits on many other fields to make the discoveries of a new class. And then the synthetic biology acts as engineers to take that class and expand it and characterize it and fit it in so it's interoperable with other engineered parts. The discovery mode itself is not something that the synthetic biology community is currently feels like they have to master. It's something that they more get from other fields. And I think the metagenomics that you talked about, you know, going through the rainforest of the ocean, doesn't do needs to and occasionally does functional screens where it's not just doing sequence screens but actually trying to find new functions. But I think there's a possibility for those fusing in the future where synthetic biology allows us to screen for lots more functionalities by creating really elaborate selections rather than simple selections like what binds to this or, you know, is resistant to this. You could actually make a complicated device to look for a complicated device.
Do you view synthetic biology as a method to create entirely new organisms, or do you feel that it is best used in the field of health where retooling might only require one or two genes to be changed? Or using it in method for health and changing someone's physiology entirely by complex traits, by multiple genes?
Well, there's a bunch of questions there. I mean, I think synthetic biology is that well. synthetic biology is not just limited to health, certainly. I mean, there's biofuels, there's all kinds of chemicals that it can make antibodies in vitro and in vivo biosensors. But
terrification?
Excuse me?
Terrification. So last week we had the Phoenix Mars mission, and they're going off onto Mars to look for the conditions where one organic molecules are, if life was there, and or determining the resources required to terrify.
Well, or really, terraform.
Sorry, yeah. Terrify. I'm terrified.
Yeah. No. What I'm worried about is that we terraform it before we discover whether there's life there. And if there's fragile life there or any kind, I think we should try our best to discover it before we contaminate it, because it could be mind-boggling.
Well, they have some phenomenal instrumentation that would, if there's going to be life, the bets are that they would find it.
Well, we have a NASA-funded project to send a miniaturized PCR machine up to Mars.
Wow.
Yeah, and the principle being that there's a lot of exchange of material between Mars and Earth, and if life evolved on Mars and came to Earth or somehow made it from Earth to Mars, then they should have a common ancestry, and this could be a really unique, could be very ancient separation, and so that's worth finding. And it's also, if there is a little ecosystem there, say in the poles where there's more water, or wherever deep in the earth, we should understand that, because it's probably the most alien environment that we're going to see, and it profoundly changed the way we think about our place in the solar system.
So, how did that project get started? How does one decide, hey, I think I can, I think it that if there is a coevolution, or the origin of the primordial soup, had it been on Mars or here and exchanged, how do you put that into the form of a grant? I'm just curious, because that is absolutely phenomenal hypothesis to test.
Well, do
you talk about it first? Or do you talk about it first with the people at the NIH or NASA?
Well, I don't think NIH would fund that. Okay, talk. This was kind of conversations that Gary Rufkin and Mike Finney and I had, Maria Zuber at MIT, and we put together with pennies that we had lying around and many years without funding, and then eventually qualified for NASA, approved of the project but didn't fund it, and then later it funded it, and then there's a whole series of steps you need to go through to, prove like 2 years in advance that your method is really working. And then there's another 2 year delay, before it actually is on a mission. There's typically a mission. There's a window of opportunity every 2 years, because of the relative planetary motion.
This is genetics on the planetary level. This is phenomenal.
It's a fun project. I mean, it's a bit of a long shot, but we do know that that rocks are exchanged between the two planets. So, yeah.
I would like to take a minute to thank Invitrogen for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. We're kind of doing a mini-series here on cloning using Invitrogen technologies. These technologies, I really do think, accelerate the process of cloning and subcloning genes. I mean, I've used them, and they have saved me a ton of time. So in the first week, we talked about topo cloning, which consists of a 5-minute reaction to insert a PCR product into a vector. Next, we talked about gateway and how you can make a single vector that can recombine into a large number of expression systems. I think there's 15. There could even be more now. Well, today in the last of the mini-series, I'm going to talk about the Zero Blunt Topo PCR cloning kits. These kits combine the ease of Topo PCR cloning with the Zero Background technology, which is actually really useful for blunt end and long PCR products. As you know well, these typically result in high backgrounds. So the Zero Blunt Topo PCR vector is a vector that has a lethal CCDB gene, or CCDB for Controlled Cell Death B gene. And here's how it works. You do your 5-minute topo reaction with a blunt end PCR product. and you transform competent cells. If the vector recircularizes, it brings the lethal gene into frame and kills the cell. Hence, no recircularization background. It's really a great one-step cloning strategy for long, blunt-ended PCR products, though I would use it also for short PCR products, but I digress. So Invitrogen's having a special. If you buy a Topo PCR cloning kit, including the Zero Blunt kit, you get 15% off selected high-fidelity PCR enzymes. Simply use the promo code RTPCWU as a promo code for the U.S., and RTPCWC for Canada. Don't worry, I have a link in the show notes to the special at twit.tv/fib. So, back to the interview with Dr. Church.
Do you need proof that there's organic molecules on Mars before you send a probe out there with a thermal cycler to do PCR? Now, the audience, just to remind them, or at least my dad who's listening, PCR is a method, polymerase chain reaction, that allows you to take one single molecule or just about one single molecule of DNA and then make trillions of copies. So if there is one copy left, you can recover it and amplify those genes, I guess somewhat in the same way that, you know, Jurassic Park would, you know, amplify or clone a genome. You can bring things back. And you actually have done most of the work or a lot of the work on some of that, single, you know, genome copy, what do you call it? Cloning by PCR, cloning.
Right. Yeah. Polymerase colonies or polonies or polymerase clones or plones. It's a great in vitro way of getting nucleic acids amplified from as little as a single molecule or even a piece of a molecule, piece of a DNA molecule, which is multiple atoms.
So the question was, do you need organic chemistry, or do you need to know that there's the chemistry on Mars to be able to send that probe?
I think if we're searching for evidence of life on Mars, we need to try multiple things simultaneously, because the cost of these missions and the infrequency with which we can go there. So I think it may turn out that it's easier to detect DNA than it is to detect organic molecules, because DNA can work with very trace, you know, single molecules in fairly large volumes, while most of the analytic methods, you know, require sort of millions of molecules per microliter, and, you know, or per reasonable droplet that you would do, you would pull out of soil. So there's an exquisite sensitivity to PCR. And if you can also think of it, if you do find organics, then you might doubt it. But if you find organics and you find PCR on the same mission, then suddenly you got a story that's much more believable. For example, in the first Mars mission that tried to look for life, they set in advance the criterion by which, if we see this, then we will declare there's life on Mars. And lo and behold, they did the experiment, and they saw, it passed the test. And what was their conclusion? They said, it's badly designed experiment. Oh, but, you know, they basically said, you know, they basically backtracked from their, you made a decision. This is, if we see this result, then there's life on Mars. They saw the result, and they didn't conclude what they said they were going to conclude. And if they thought it was a badly designed experiment, they should have decided that in advance, right? So why does it suddenly occur to them just because they got positive results? So I think that's why you want to have multiple ways of seeing it and have less ways for people to slip out of the conclusions that there is life.
How would you eliminate the possibility of a false positive that probe is carrying DNA from the JPL or Jet Propulsion Laboratory members over to Mars?
So,
I mean, if it can,
so,
from few atoms.
So what you hope for is that the sequence will be a sequence never seen before. You know, we can do all kinds of control experiments where we sample dust in the lab where the lander is assembled. It's everything is sterilized on these missions because they don't want to introduce bacteria from Earth anyway. Even if we weren't doing PCR, they would have very strict rules for But nevertheless, if we sequence, in some sense, identify the some of the sequences that we amplify on Mars, and they don't correspond to anything on Earth, including all the controls we did, then that's fairly convincing, I would think.
Do you have any students working on this too? Graduate students?
It's mostly professional staff. It's a fairly small project. It's distributed among our various labs.
Because it'd be a really fun thesis. Because
certainly once the data starts rolling in, it could be fun. It's fun in the engineering side as well. In a certain sense, many of the things we do in the lab feed into it. It's like all the projects in the lab are interdigitated in various ways. They synergize. So the more we learn about PCR, the easier it is for us to miniaturize it so that it fits in less than a 1 kilogram payload. and the more we learn about contamination in the lab, the better we can protect against contamination. So in a way, none of the graduate students are, and all of them are, depending on how you look at it.
I'll have one last question on the Mars project. I actually took me very much by surprise. But of course, if you get a positive, and it's really a positive, this is of course one of the biggest discoveries of the decade, if not century, if not since the first scientist that looked up through broken lenses and saw canals. Right? What was the scientist that? The astronomer that looked Herschel?
I can't recall.
I'll edit that part out. Maybe. So what if it wasn't DNA, right? And your PCR is based on the ability to fly from DNA. Is there any chance that you can send in a reverse transcriptase? Because, I mean, the theory is that life first started off as RNA, or replicating molecules of ribonucleic acid, before DNA. Where do you see RNA as a possibility of?
Oh yeah, I think we certainly want to be able to get the broadest set of nucleic acids, maybe even things that are a little bit beyond RNA and DNA, is possible. Challenging, but certainly RNA and DNA are relatively straightforward to get those, as something we can detect and analyze and sequence.
How about before? Even the self-replicating molecules of RNA.
I think that moves into one of the other modules. For example, there's some modules that are looking for any kind of chiral asymmetry. That is a very general capability, which I think is important to have on the mission. The original one was to see if you had any kind of metabolism. So there. I think there are a number of different approaches, but we're focusing on nucleic acid like polymers. Nucleic acid like polymers.
When are you sending the box up?
I don't think the date has been set.
Okay.
Could be at the earliest 2011.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly glad you're doing this, because this is this is going to really stimulate the world of science, and it's like sort of buying a lottery ticket to an extent, lottery type science, where if you don't buy the ticket, you're not going to win, but somebody's got to be trying. And
exactly. And we certainly need to know if we are planning on even if we're not planning on terraforming, if we're just planning on sending people up there, or even complicated robots that could have a higher chance of contamination. The sooner we figure out what's there already, the sooner we avert an ecological loss, lost opportunity. So I think it's a fairly high priority to rule out life if we don't find it. I mean, we need to very rigorously rule it out by sending probes to very many different locations and drilling down and all that.
Well, even if there was just traces of organic molecules that were left, sort of footprints of, footprints.
Well, the problem is there are organic molecules throughout interstellar dust. So merely having carbon covalently bonded to other atoms isn't enough.
Maybe large complex.
Right.
Metabolites, I suppose. Our traditional metabolites, or maybe less traditional metabolites. I think if there's anything positive, I think the world will.
Well, there was something positive in the first mission. We have a much higher bar now. The chirality is something you don't get from, you don't expect from interstellar dust without life. Although you actually find
what
some
chirality is.
So chirality is if you have a collection of atoms. They will have a handedness to them. So let's say you have four atoms arranged in a tetrahedral, in a tetrahedron, three around us, four around a central atom, a fifth atom. Then you can arrange them in two mirror images. And if you see a preponderance of one mirror image, ideally an exclusive one, so almost all of the molecules in our bodies, a huge fraction of the ones in our polymers, like DNA, RNA, and protein, are made up of have a handedness to them. So if you tend to see one handedness, not the other, then that's a very good indication of life.
So if all the the compounds are left-handed, then you know that that was an enzymatic.
That's right.
Well, we'll keep an eye open for that.
Right.
Well, so that was already found. No, you were saying that was not the
original test was more of a metabolic test looking for evolution of carbon dioxide gas, and they sort of at some point, I think after the positive results came in, they came up with some way to explain it away with ordinary chemistry, not living chemistry, which they should have thought of in advance because it sounds like a kind of a post hoc wimping out.
You have to learn how to do an experiment, and the only way to learn how to do an experiment is to do an experiment, I suppose. You never get it right the first time.
Right.
Or unless,
I mean, well, they could have visualized that outcome. They could have said, oh, yeah, it produced carbon dioxide gas. Now, what are we going to say? And they could have said, oh, we're going to say it was a bad experiment. Well, they could have announced in the beginning that no matter how this turns out, we're not going to declare there was life.
Wow.
They could have announced that, but maybe that wasn't.
Maybe they need some better reviewers at the point of putting the project together. So actually we've got a lot of great material here. But I was wondering there's so many different areas of your work that I'd like to go into. Maybe we could have you back in a couple of weeks or in a month or so. I'm wondering.
Whatever you want.
Because this would be really great. I think that this would be fun to do if we can do a follow-up episode. We did it with Mark Vidal, and it really gave us a really good understanding of his interactome work because it's fairly complex. And one area that I'd like to talk to you about is how you see genomics at the system level. How do you pull out information that's relevant to processes like aging and cancer? And so that's one area that I'd like to talk to you about. Another is I'd like to sort of explore some of the some more of the synthetic biology. So how about this as an exit question, and then we'll have you back. So in was it Nature Genetics? Let's see, I've got the literature here. Nature Genetics. The question of the year last year was what would you do if it became possible to sequence the equivalent of a full human genome for only $1,000? What would you do? And what was your answer? Do you mind answering it for us, or is there any?
Sure. My answer was that if it really scales perfectly, which is possible, then you should be able to do a subset of the genome for less than $1,000, and maybe 1% would be $10 or something like that, and. To some extent, no matter what the price is, you might want to get more genomes for less money. And in any case, right now, you might be able to do 1% of the genome for $1,000 and get a million people sequenced and interpret that data in ways that they might find interesting, and then
how
sort
would you
of
pick the 1% that you want to sequence?
Well, you would start out with an intention to get the whole thing, but you would start out with the protein coding regions, splice junctions, which are right next to them, a few extra percent for that. Not percent of the total, but a couple extra base pairs for every splice junction. RNA start sites, one per gene or more. And that might add up to 1%. And then you could make it 2% as you find more regulatory elements that are conserved or not conserved over between organisms. And that would be a starting point. Anything that's shown to be a causative allele in the disease or is likely to be a causative allele, then you prioritize those up. And there will probably be a 1% of the genome, which accounts for 90% of the traits. We won't necessarily guess that 1% perfectly the first time, but there will be a huge enrichment, and that enrichment is what cost effectiveness is all about. You can get 95% of the information for 1% the cost, then you should do it.
Is that happening? How many genomes have been sequenced right now? Is it 2 or 3 human genomes?
Oh, it depends on what you mean by sequence. No human genome has been sequenced in its entirety, and about almost 300 have been done in part, meaning that you have a reference sequence and then you superimpose on that variability due to single nucleotide polymorphisms, insertion, deletion elements, both large and small. When they get very, very large, they tend to be called copy number variants, and then various other rearrangements like inversions. So you have all these things that you can superimpose on the genome, and the more of them you get, the more you have characterized a new and individual genome. So now that we're doing genome-wide association studies with whole genome single nucleotide polymorphism chips, there are literally thousands of people who are being analyzed as diploid, meaning both mom and dad's inheritance, at sort of a 70-80% level for single nucleotide polymorphisms. Now, that doesn't cover all the indels, but in terms of things that are linked to disease, this is the plan. But
the efforts are focusing right now on just the single mutations or small mutations that are associated with disease on the large scale.
Well, it turns out that a good fraction of the variation that you see among people is in single nucleotide polymorphisms that you can track with very inexpensive chips, about $250 per person per whole genome survey. And those, either the point mutations themselves or something to which they are linked, which could be a more complicated insertion deletion, could be kilobases away, you can use those as surrogates. And so very cost effectively you can study, and we have now studied thousands of individuals, which are cases and controls with and without a disease. So the answer is nobody's been sequenced in their entirety, and by this trick of having markers as surrogates for additional variation, thousands of people have been done.
Wow. Do you see a time when the cost will get so low that everybody will just have everything, including the junk, what they call junk?
Well, yeah, we don't know if there's junk yet, right. But there certainly are regions that are much more neutral, meaning it doesn't matter what happens there, more so than other regions. It might get. I mean, it's been my goal for about 30-some years to get it affordable, sort of in the $1,000, $2,000 range for whole genomics. But I think the way to get it there is to do a portion so you can get it at $1,000 today, and then instead of bringing the price down, you bring the product that you get for that fixed price to be more and more valuable, upgraded every year.
It sounds like you're very proactive, because that's the kind of approach that will get work done now and won't wait. Exactly. You don't procrastinate.
Exactly. Well. I'm very proactive, very very dedicated to getting this available to as many people that want it, and also making it interpretable and, you know, socially responsible in a way so that it's not overinterpreted and misused.
Well, it's, this is going to be a transition towards a personalized medicine, I suppose, when we can get that. I mean, I know I personally have had a number of genes sequenced for some of the things that I have. hematologists are doing it more and more. And as the technologies get better and better, they can focus on trying to get eliminate misdiagnosis by finding out what people have inherited from their parents.
Which is phenomenal. I agree. It's very important. Yeah.
It'll save a lot of lives. I really appreciate you coming on.
Sure. My pleasure. Look forward to chatting some other time.
Yeah. Well, there's actually so much to cover, and we'll definitely have to continue this. I've got so many questions, but I'll save it or else nobody's going to be able to download this. It'll be too large. So thanks.
Okay. Well, feel free to cut whatever you want or save it or what. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
One thing that I've learned through doing these interviews is that some of the best ideas and thoughts come after the interview. So what I did is I kept the tape rolling and asked Dr. Church's permission to air the recording. So here we go again.
I think I think it's sort of at the black hole stage now. It's like no one has ever, used black holes to drive their car or anything, right?
Right.
And for the most part, the discoveries of the Genome Project were, discoveries that only a mother could love. It's like the number of genes and copy number variants and things like that. They either fell in a category where we sort of already knew it, or it's a detail, or it's a million details.
Well, there's a lot of information that just from the genome itself we can medically, simple from medicine, not just understanding, but the biology of the human organism, but for example, I have a metabolic disease and it was mapped down to a gene, but unless my brother sequences that gene, he's not going to know whether he has it. And of course, sequencing is the key, and the answer is there and it lies before him. He just has to go to the right clinic that can do sequencing and sequence a specific gene. And
I think people are going to be just insatiable appetite for this. It's going to be kind of like, knowledge of internal combustion engines at the turn of the 20th century is that everybody's suddenly getting cars and you just got to understand it, or computers in the 1990s when the internet started getting accepted. Just everybody's got to learn about it, and it's just going to be insatiable, and it's going to be about them. And unlike the internet where you could say, oh, that's, I don't need to worry about that because, I don't need to have it in my house. You've got your body, you're stuck with it. You can't get rid of it. You got to understand it, right? If everybody else is,
Well, it might be the century of biotech. We are exploring other fields of science, but it's undeniable. The amount of information over the next 50 years is going to be tremendous. And the concept that we just may, with the combination of all the OM projects, the proteome and transcriptome and interactome, and the amount of information, and then using it, apply it to synthetic biology as well. We're coming to a point, what I call a singularity in biotech, where, our ability to control lifespan, our metabolism, all these things could be, either pharmacologically or genetically modified. And this is inevitable with all technological development. We're now just moving into the world of the life technologies. So
right.
It's going to be fun. This is going to be great. And I hope to cover it and give people a firsthand account.
Singularities may not be fun. We don't know. We've never, very few people have been into a singularity and come back to talk about it.
Well,
but overall, it probably should be fun, at least until the actual singularity occurs.
I'll refer back to the episode on the singularity with Drew Andy's answer to that. He had a brilliant answer, and I'll let people tune back to that. He had so many different levels of analysis. It was great.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks again. And
sure.
Do you mind if I put some of that on? A little trick in recording episodes is sometimes people feel more relaxed and there's some great content, great information. So I'm going to,
as far as I'm concerned, I assume everything's always recorded, even,
that's on
even when I'm not talking to somebody. So Yeah, you could use, I try to always say things that are suitable, you know. Ooh. And I'm not even that concerned about my speech impediments. You could put those on if you want to.
Right.
We have to be open and transparent, right?
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll let you go and I'll contact your assistants and we'll schedule
sure.
The second part of this and
okay.
We'll talk a little bit more about applied genomics.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. I'd really like to thank Dr. George Church for being on the show. It was really kind of him to accept the invitation. He's a professor of genetics and the director of the Center for Computational Genetics at Harvard Medical School. I'd like to thank Phil Pelsey and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. And lastly, for the disclaimer, the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelsey.
So what's the funding source? No, for your
In vitrogen?
For your program. Oh, it's in vitrogen? Okay.
So it's very limited interruption.
So we don't have to do any product placement like, you know, how George Church really loves his gateway, right?
Well, Mark Vidal already did it.
Did he? Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty genuine.
Yeah, I know. And he was actually...
I'm not even sure we use it. I'm sure we do. If my lab's big enough, somebody probably uses it. But...
Oh, I'm okay. Sure. It's so much. Well, maybe we'll let this is product placement. It'll be part of our ad.
No, I should check with my lab before I say that.
Well, I use it.
Okay, there you go.
I can't clone with restriction enzymes anymore. It's just too much of a pain. But you are ahead of the game with recombinational cloning, probably. And those methods. So we'll get into that. Actually, I mean, okay. I think recombinational cloning and. A homologous recombination if you really take advantage of it. I mean, that's how Gateway works, but in part, it really gives us a tremendous amount of power over the genome.